Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, and welcome to Foment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. My name is Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Mary Izette, and we are your co-hosts for this journey through all things fermentable, airing live every Monday night on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
And iTunes. Archived on iTunes.
As well as the station.
We are on a crazy, crazy fermentable high right now. We're just back from the National Home Brewers Conference, where Mary knocked it out of the park, giving a seminar on alternative fermented beverages.
And urban brewing.
How'd you feel about that?
I was really nervous.
Repping the show and repping Heritage Radio. It was awesome. It was really great. I was incredibly proud of you, and you served an amazing short mead during that, which is I'm very excited to talk about, because today we have two guests today. We have our friends.
Three, actually.
Well, actually, yes. Two topical guests. Mm-hmm. Greg Heller LaBelle is on the phone, as well as Michael Manning from the Colony
Meadery.
That's right. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great.
Yeah, really well.
Tell us about the Colony Meadery and what's going on. You guys have a TTB license, but are getting set to open up this year?
Yeah, we're at this point, the TTB gave us approval, and we are just waiting on the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to give us the final okay. And we expect to be up and producing within a month.
Awesome.
In Allentown, Pennsylvania, right over the Delaware River.
And we tried a couple of your meads while we were at NHC. Now, we did not get the tomato mead.
No, we missed that one.
The mojito mead.
Yes, it's the mojito.
It was pouring at night, at club night, but it went really quickly.
Yeah.
It was gone pretty much. We had heard that it went on, and by the time we got over to our booth, it was gone.
Mm. Wow. Mary was saying that was going to be one of your flagships with this?
Yeah, we're going to have a series of cocktail-themed meads. So we'll have the Momito, and we'll have the Pina Comida and the Margamita.
Nice. This is awesome. So you're going to be up and running in like a month, but how long of a turnaround do you think you're going to take on your meads?
Mike can tell you the full.
I think I'll step in at this point. This is Mike.
Hey, Mike.
How are you?
You're more on the brewing side of this, and you actually won Best in Show for the Valhalla mead competition.
Yes, back in 2011, and that was with the Momito.
Oh,
that
man,
pretty much
awesome.
That's what launched this project. But because we were moving commercial, we decided let's see what we can turn around with some quicker meads, and we found out that the dry hydromels we can have in bottles and ready to consume in a month, total time, a couple weeks to ferment and a couple weeks to infuse some flavor and bottle and out they go.
That is awesome.
So we're going to have a couple of different hop meads that we plan on putting in kegs to serve in bars, and we've got a bone dry hydromel with lots of herbs and spices in it to really hit up the wine drinking market, hopefully.
And that was similar to is that the one that you served at NHC during your social club slot?
During the hospitality suite. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I had that one. It was delicious.
Thank you.
Have you guys ever made any short meads?
Meaning like 6% and under?
I have not done that yet, but I am working on something like that. Another thing that we can try to turn out pretty quick. That's what we're trying to find some things we can turn out quick, and we're trying to also have some stuff that's really unique that no one else will have.
Yeah. Awesome.
So, Michael, why meads? When did you get into meads?
I got into meads for kicks and giggles. I'd been a home brewer for a bunch of years, and our club wanted to participate in Mead Day as a group, so we all got together, and each one of us made different meads. I made my mead, and I think the American Homebrew Association published recipe that year was for herbs, and I just went with straight mint, and it turned out pretty good. The next year, I said, hey, I love mojitos. Let me add lime to this, and my meads started coming out a lot better than my beer, so I went down the mead line.
That's fantastic.
Now, you guys are doing a crowdfunding campaign on Rocket Hub. So tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Rocket Hub's it's a crowdfunding platform actually located in New York. Some really great guys. And they've got a tie-in with the A&E Network's sort of program called Project Startup, where they're featuring a lot of entrepreneurs and people that have projects on Rocket Hub that have success, and particularly around manufacturing. One of the reasons, obviously that was a big reason we went with Rocket Hub, and also that they're very they're kind of indie like us. It's very lean startup. They didn't get venture backing. It's all about using your friends and your family and the quality of your product and your work ethic. And so that really appealed to us.
That's awesome. Where are you going to source your honey? And what size are you going to start with?
Well, we're going to have 2 3-barrel fermenters as primaries and 2 1-barrel fermenters. Our plan with the 3 barrels are ferment one big batch and then split it into smaller batches and flavor them differently. That kind of helps us get variety out in a much quicker time frame than do one batch at a time. Sourcing of the honey, we've got Dutch Gold, who supplies lots of honey all over the country out here in Lancaster, PA. They're a little over an hour from us. I've got another local honey producer in Easton, Pennsylvania named Sants. And we've got a bunch of local apiists right here in Lehigh Valley in our backyard that we use some of their wildflower honey with.
Awesome. Now, you guys you have a space in Allentown. Are you going to have, how does that work with the meadery? Will you be able to have a tasting room or, kind of tours or?
Yeah, we're going to be in, it's a manufacturing incubator. So it's built around startup companies that are doing some type of manufacturing. And we have a space in it. It's actually an old plant that used to be used by Mack Truck, and now they've really renovated it. And it's a sort of beautiful facility. And we have this one suite, and there's a room in front that has direct access out onto the street, and it's going to be a great tasting room for people to come in, and we'll be able to have everything there, and they can come in and see the place.
Super. Now, you guys, on Rocket Hub, so if people want to donate to your campaign, the crowdfunding campaign on Rocket Hub, you guys can go to colonymeadery.com. And, Greg, I know you were telling me at NHC that every dollar counts.
Yeah, because of the tie-in with A&E, one of the things that we want to demonstrate is not just, obviously, everyone wants to hit their funding goal because money helps buy things like fermenters, but it's also about just the number of people. So even if everyone, if people come on and they give $5, it adds one more person to that number of funders, and it says to to A&E and to Rocket Hub and to everyone, look, there's people that are behind this that even if they can't give, a ton of money, that really want to see some new flavors, some new artisanal beverages, some gluten-free, things like that, stuff that we're not seeing enough of in the market right now.
Absolutely. Great. So again, the website is colonymeadery.com. No, The Colony Meadery, excuse me, thecolonymeadery.com. And we look forward to talking to you guys in the future once you've opened, and then hopefully we'll have you here for Mead Week next
year. That's right. Mead Week.
Absolutely. That'd be fantastic.
That'd be awesome. Great. Out of curiosity, do you guys know the stats on how many meaderies there are or how many meads are being produced in the United States? Not being imported, but do you know what's around?
I know there's about 1,000 places that are producing something called mead, but the vast majority of them are wineries that are doing, maybe one honey wine or something like that.
Sure.
Actual, full meaderies, there's very, very few. I think we figured out right now there's really only 2 in Pennsylvania. We would be the 3rd that's really doing only mead.
Yeah.
That isn't a winery with one honey wine.
And that's really a lot for any state.
Yeah, it really is.
Well, that's awesome. We totally commend what you guys are doing. I think there should be a lot more mead out there and varietals, and I'm really looking forward to these. Thank you guys so much.
Yep, and good luck.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Mead.
High five for mead.
That was an on-air high five for all of you out there. Thank you for joining in on the high five. One thing that's also great about NHC is just the inspiration that you get on the floor of club night. I've never seen what the National Brewers Conference is about, but basically, the highlight of that whole event for me is happens on Friday night, where there's a giant beer festival, and instead of individual breweries, there's individual homebrew clubs all serving their homebrew. And we were lucky enough to meet our next guest, Brian Hall. How you doing, Brian?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Fantastic. So I met you as I was hanging out with another beer somewhere, and Mary came up to me. She's like, "Oh my god, my god, you got to come have this beer. You got to meet Brian." And she took me straight there to show you where. First of all, who are you? Where are you from?
My name is Brian Hall. I am currently living right now in Portland, Maine. I've been there for 2 years. Before that, I was a resident in Alaska. So, and I've been brewing for about 8 or 9 years now, give or take.
That's fantastic.
So I was walking through the aisle. So at club night, I have to have an approach, because there's a lot. I mean, there's hundreds of beers. So I only drink weird. So I'm walking by the main booth and I see Cool Ship, and I was like, Cool Ship, what? So I went up to Brian. I said, "What's the deal with the Cool Ship beer?" And he said,
"Yeah,
I have a Cool Ship."
I took a standard 15.5 gallon keg, and I cut it in half vertically to kind of give me two equal sized baths, and one of them got a home in the front of our house, where there's a whole bunch of open space where you can let the air come in, and that was the birth of the Cool Ship.
So what is a Cool Ship? Why is a Cool Ship?
So a Cool Ship is a device. It's traditionally used in Belgium. What you do is, when you are done doing the normal steps in brewing beer, instead of cooling it down quickly and transferring it to a fermenting vessel, what you do is you put it into a Cool Ship, which is kind of like a giant stainless steel bathtub that's about 12 inches deep and can be quite large in size. And the hot wort, or the beer that has just been brewed, now sits in the Cool Ship, and it will cool down over the course of 12 to 14 hours. And during that time, natural wild yeast from the local environment get in there and start the fermentation process. So instead of choosing your strain of what yeast you want to have, you get what's in the air at the time.
And you sounds like you have an excellent location. You said you're on the water.
Right. We're right across the street from the Presumpscot Bay in Portland, Maine, within about 5 to 6 miles of Allagash Brewing Company, which is kind of the big name when it comes to Cool Ship on the eastern coast. And so I got kind of inspired by what I've seen them doing, but what I've read about in different different articles here and there. And I thought, you know, if they're doing this, why can't I? Mine has the problem of it cools down a little too quickly, but nevertheless, I thought I'd give it a try. And I opened up all the windows, actually, when Hurricane Sandy came through. And a lot of air going through the house at that time, and something got in there that produced some pretty good beer.
Awesome. So let's talk about your technique, because you said you can put 7.5 gallons in the Cool Ship. Is
right.
that correct?
Yep, I can fit about 7 gallons is about the maximum.
So you're running off 7 gallons of your mash into, or your boiled
yep.
wort into your Cool Ship,
yep.
letting it cool and collect wild yeast. Then what are your steps past that?
And then after that, I put it into like a normal fermentation vessel, whether it's stainless or glass. And hopefully within anywhere between 1 to 5 days, you see some activity. I've had some instances where nothing happened and I saw mold, and so that's not as awesome. But if you start to get the thick krausen on top, it starts foaming and looks like it's almost like a very slow boil. That activity, that's really a good thing. And then you really hope that it comes out well, because you're looking at about a wait time of over a year. There's no real quick way to see if it worked. So this the one that I brought to the NHC that you tried, mm-hmm. Was since Hurricane Sandy. So it wasn't even hardly almost a year old.
And was that particular beer, was that put into a barrel, or it was just fermented normally in a carboy?
That was a small batch. That was only a 5 gallon batch. That
okay.
was just in a standard carboy. But I have started getting more interested in barrels and how beers act when they have a little bit of oxygen introduced to them while they are allowed to ferment. So I have been obtaining barrels from different vineyards and other breweries that are done with them, and brewing my own beers and putting them inside of those.
So the Cool Ship beer, once you racked it, once you transferred from the Cool Ship to your carboy, it didn't. Then you capped it with a traditional airlock.
Yep, and traditional airlock, because I
okay.
don't want to let anything else get in there.
Right.
And once the yeast has got its initial amount of oxygen, it wants to go into more of an anaerobic phase,
yep.
meaning you don't want to have extra oxygen in there.
No acetobacter.
You're right, exactly.
Awesome. All right, so with that, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back to talk more about Brian's Cool Ship and his barrel action.
Ferment about it.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
All right, welcome back to Fomentavada at heritageradionetwork.org. I want to start this segment out with a giant toast to the USA for finally, first time since Prohibition to date, all 50 states allow homebrewing to occur. So cheers.
Yep.
First time since Prohibition, all 50 states are legally allowed to homebrew. That was a lot of work from the American Homebrewers Association and people in their own states. It was Alabama and Mississippi was the last one, right, today?
Yep.
To get that together. Pretty awesome.
Well, they had both passed, but
today's when it went into effect, yeah. As we discussed last week with Gary.
Yep.
And stuff. And Brian.
Yeah.
So you have some barrels at your house. So we just went through the process of you're fermenting in the carboy. Mm-hmm. What do you do from there?
So if I'm not going to barrel age, it actually just sits in the carboy for up to a year or two or three, depending on the brew. If I'm doing a larger batch, those are the ones that I'll put in the barrels. The barrels I use are about 50 gallons, and so I only get a couple a year. And I brew a large batch. I moved to Maine with a very small system, and since then I've gotten a 1.5 barrel system, and so I can brew up an entire barrel at a time and get together with friends, and we'll make an afternoon out of it. So as far as the cool shit beers, those will actually just sit for a year, year and a half, and then I'll put in some new yeast, because by that time, sometimes some of the yeast has gone dormant. And so I'll add some new yeast and bottle it and let it bottle condition and then let it hang out until I feel like drinking it. As far as the barrel-aged beers, the two that I have done recently, I did a Flanders Red style, which I chose a yeast and put that in, so that was not a cool shit beer. As far as the other barrels, I did what's called a traditional turbid mash, which is a version of a step mash, kind of combined with a decoction, where you are taking out the wort at certain points before it has completely converted and turned those starches into sugars, which is what you're going for. And what that does is it allows more time for the different wild yeast, or it allows more food for the wild yeast to consume over time. And some of those yeasts, like Brettanomyces, need more oxygen, or they thrive with oxygen. And so what a barrel does is a barrel is slightly porous, and so it allows that oxygen to go through. I really like reading about the traditions of beer and how beer originally started in barrels. So I read through that, and I called every vineyard I could find in Maine, and eventually I obtained a couple of Riesling barrels and put some beer in those. So they turned out kind of whiny, so what I've done now is started rinsing them, and that's what I've got my lambic sitting in right now.
So do you rinse them in between each yield?
I do. I rinse them, or I'll rinse them with boiling water to try and neutralize as many of the yeast in there I can. They're going to get into the wood, so it's going to be hard to do completely, but that's the goal.
Then with the batches, so have you had batches go in and already come out of the barrel?
Yeah, so okay. The one that was on draft at the NHC was the barrel-aged Saison, and that I used a Y-yeast French Saison yeast, and it sat in the barrel for about 8 months.
Okay.
And so it has really strong wine characteristics to it. It has, kind of tastes like Riesling, to be honest. It was a barrel that was up at Breakwater Vineyards in Maine, for about 13 years as a Riesling barrel, and they decommissioned it and passed it on to me for a small sum.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I thought it tasted like, I mean, the Riesling definitely trumped the Saison, but I thought it was it was not an unbalanced beer, though, overall. I mean, I thought it was very drinkable. Yeah. And
I've drank a lot of it, so to me it tastes like a lot like Riesling. But yeah, I got a lot of good reviews from people because I warned them. I said, this is kind of harsh. It's going to taste a little like Riesling more than Saison. And the reviews back were, no, it didn't. I think part of it is the barrel flavor mellows over time.
Right.
I did a whiskey barrel-aged porter a couple years ago. And you have a bottle of that now, and you can hardly tell that it was in it. But when it came right out, it was very strong whiskey tasting.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I haven't played with barrels enough. I'm excited to.
Yeah.
Very excited to.
We have a very small one at home.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun. I like the larger ones because you can leave it in for a longer amount of time because you have a little less surface area than the small ones are. But, you know, any barrel you can get your hands on, go for it.
How much do you ever top them off? I mean, do you get a bunch of leaking or evaporating?
Yeah, I do get a little bit. Sometimes I'll top them off with fresh wort just to kind of keep the yeast going. Sometimes I will use a beer that's already fermented that's a similar style. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you lose what's called the angel's share from that evaporation there.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
Now, how are you indoctrinating your? Are you dosing your barrels with wild yeast
other
inbred?
Cultures?
Yeah.
So one of the barrels right now has a lambic yeast from Y yeast in it. Because when you're doing at a home brewing level, when you're doing a barrel that's 50 gallons, that's a lot of home brew. I mean, you're looking at 12 5-gallon kegs, which means you got to have a lot of friends, or you're doing something else with it. But so I usually use a yeast that I know to be good. Now the yeast that we discussed earlier that ended up in the cool ship. I have since harvested that yeast, put it into slants and small tubes and store it in my refrigerator. So at any time I can go back in there and pull something very similar to that yeast back out. And I'll probably use that in the future. But right now I'm just loving playing with everything.
Cool.
Were you inspired by any other beers on Club Night?
or in
Social Club or anything there that you think like, wow, I'm going to try. I got some new ideas now from...
It was nice. There was a guy, East Coast Yeast puts out all their different strains, and there was somebody there that had an East Coast Yeast from strain 20, which is a wild yeast. I think it's a blend of their ECY 1 through 5s. I'm not exactly sure. But he had a beer that had sat on that for a year and a half, and I just a week and a half ago did a 50-gallon barrel of that exact same yeast. So it was okay. Nice to see that, all right, in a year, year and a half or two, this might be what it tastes like. So that was... That was some positive reinforcement. There weren't particularly a lot of sour and wild beers at the NHC, which, I don't know, for me is motivating to kind of get more of those out there just because the complexity is amazing.
Yeah. We were considering as a guild going next year and maybe doing, you know, like you said, it's really hard to navigate in that room sometimes because you're like, what do I want to get from everybody?
Right.
Everybody has so many different things and everybody's coming with a diversity of stuff. So we were thinking maybe having our booth be themed like per hour, like having the sour hour and then the session hour and then like the imperial hour, or the IPA hour or the hot bomb hour and you know, variations on a theme.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I think we got 3.5 hours or 4 hours to play with.
Yeah, because it's hard to find some of those. There are some great beers out there at the conference. It's just, you know, it's a lot of trial and error figuring out which ones you like.
Yeah.
But. We were using Google Hangouts, all the NYC homebrewers. So people would say, hey, there's a sour over at, you know, this booth or whatever. There was actually a very nice Guza at the Brewing Network booth that I had. I had a sour from a guy who made a spiced holiday beer, and he added Cantillon dregs, and that actually soured beautifully.
Did you talk to him? When did he add those dregs?
In secondary, I believe.
Okay.
And then, and he said that was a happy accident because he had made some sours that didn't work out at all.
Right.
So,
yeah, you know, that's the only problem is once you introduce this, you're looking at a year or two. So it's not like with a normal beer where you get feedback within a month, and so that can be frustrating.
Yeah, it's a little risky, but.
But usually the reward pays off.
Yeah. And then I had a consecration clone that was also very nice.
Oh, yeah.
That night, so.
Excellent.
Did any of you try? There was a friend of ours named Peter Kennedy, who's also a future guest on this. He made a bacon grease beer. He actually put bacon grease into the beer before he started fermenting.
Wow.
So he was cool in the beer, put a bunch of bacon grease in it, let it sit for like a day or two and lager it. So it got all the flavor of the bacon grease, but the grease kind of all went to one place and he sifted that off. And then he started his fermentation after that, and it was very bacon greasy, good.
I am for all things bacon.
It was good. It was fascinating. It was a fascinating beer.
Wow.
It was pretty tasty. So what were some of your highlights of the National Homebrewers Conference?
All in all. Not just.
No, like, all in all, yeah. Seminars,
overall,
everything.
For me personally. Philly. Yeah, I mean, Philly was great. Having spent limited time on the East Coast, it was fun to go see a lot of the historical sites. One of the cool things was meeting Dick Cantwell, who is the author of the Brewer's Guide to Starting Your Own Brewery,
right. Mm-hmm.
Which is something that I've been toying with in the future back up in Alaska. We're moving back up there in about 2 years.
So oh, wow. Okay.
I've been thinking about that. So, I mean, it's kind of every homebrewer's dream. But it's a lot more than just making beer and throwing it at people. There's a million steps to go through with the government as well as business licensing and those sorts of things. So the pro panel there was great. And then on the other side, it was great because I wandered in next to a beer and cheese tasting option and got to try some great cheeses and some great beers too and think about how I might do that.
Yeah. There were some good seminars there. I went to a really good cider seminar. And then the Wild Yeast Seminar was also nice.
Yeah, that was great. There was some good information there, especially when everything I do is about wild yeast. The bread I make, the beer I brew, all those sorts of things, I try to do as much wild yeast as possible.
Now, did you build your cool ship since you've been in Maine, or did you build that when you were in Alaska?
That was since I've been in Maine. When I moved to Maine, I had three small corny kegs, a brew pot, and a couple of funnels. And since then, that's grown to a whole bunch more equipment to where I can pretty much brew any kind of beer that I want to. And it's pretty much consumed our basement, living room, the front room of our house, and the yard at times. So I have a very tolerant, loving wife who supports all of this.
Awesome.
So that's been a blessing.
And are you planning on moving all that back to Alaska when you guys go?
As much as we can, yeah.
We keep talking about cool ship, but what'd you do with the other half of the barrel?
The other half is just
have two cool ships.
Well, I could in theory, but the other one's just sitting vertically. I figure it might turn into a nice lamp, or I'll give it to a give it to a friend or something like that. But yeah, don't have a need for two.
And how often are you doing the cool ship beers, or how many have you done so far?
I've done four so far, just because I'm not brewing all the time. I do have a job outside of this, believe it or not. But I have done four, and then. The rest of them are all just kind of regular beers. So, and they're sitting around right now, just aging in the basement. They'll probably get touched another year or two.
Have you done any fruit additions with some local Maine? Blueberries is the main thing, right?
I've done blueberry beers in the past, but the most exciting ones that I've done, actually, rhubarb was one of my favorites.
Yeah, we're on a rhubarb kick right
now. Rhubarb's pretty awesome. It's really cool to actually see kind of how the rhubarb changes, because if you do rhubarb in the spring when it's just sprouting up, you get a really nice fruity, acidic taste. You do it later in the year and it kind of turns grassy. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of fun to see how the fruit changes. You can also, going back to my wild yeast thing, you can get some really cool wild yeast from just dumping fruit into your beer. So I've added cherries before, I've added rhubarb, I've done apple, all those sorts of things. The possibilities are endless. I really like to stick with kind of a straight-up beer at first to see how it comes out, and then I might brew it again and then add fruit to it, because the fruit isn't going to cure a beer. It's just going to add to it. So.
Mm-hmm. So when you do that and you get the yeast from the skin of the fruit, did you just add the fruit? You finish the beer, finish the boil, cool it, throw it into your fermenter, and then throw these unwashed fruits just in there?
Yeah,
and
I'll usually dome after the primary fermentation is complete. So once that has gone through and done a nice clean fermentation,
okay.
Then I'll
so
throw
you
in
do
the fruit.
Combo,
so
it, right.
Yeah,
gotcha.
So it's a combo.
But nothing strictly with the other yeast?
Haven't done anything strict. I made a hard cider, but that's not beer.
But we're delicious. In full support of cider.
Yeah, we're absolutely. Yeah.
So on that note, I'm going to talk about, I scored at the Green Market today. So this week's Green Market beverage is actually just a strawberry water kefir. So I just used some strawberries that actually Jaren, our photographer, good friend, photographer and videographer, had picked for me on Long Island. And I strained off my water kefir and added strawberries to that. So that is ready to drink now. But the Green Markets in New York City are chock full of amazing stuff to ferment. So I picked up some gooseberries, some currants, some tart cherries are there. So tart cherries are great for beer, and then, of course, sodas. A little bit of lavender, some basil to make a strawberry basil soda, What else did I get? Oh, and some raspberries. And then there's still rhubarb left in the green market. So all of these things will be turning to soda, so we'll be talking about those in future episodes.
Absolutely. We water kefir is coming up.
Yep. We haven't done that, and wait for minute sodas as well. So
that's right. Anyway, thank you so much, Brian Oliver, for coming down.
Thank you for having
we
me.
We were very lucky to have you in the city. Yeah. It was a random visit for you.
Yeah, coming back great. NHC. I'm so glad it worked out.
Then,
thanks to Greg and Mike from the Colony Meadery. We look forward to having their meads in the future.
Please support them if you can.
Yep, on Rocket Hub.
That's right. And thanks for listening to Men About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.